Welcome to CoTeCast, the podcast for debate, discussion, and analysis of topics related to geriatric and general medicine. And today we're doing our third episode in our mini stroke series. And we've got Johnny and Chris with us. So, hello.
Hello.
Good evening.
And this episode is going to be all about acute treatment of ischemic stroke. So, shall we just start off with kind of what scares everybody, thrombolysis?
Yeah, it's a good place to start. I suppose that's probably part of what gives everyone anxiety about managing hyperacute stroke is the concept that sort of time is brain, which it absolutely is. But I think as we'd said before, time is brain is not necessarily a substitute for a good initial assessment to make sure you're actually identifying stroke correctly and that you know what it is that you're dealing with. I suppose the way that we manage stroke now has changed to how we did previously. So it used to be that we had the sort of gold standard of thrombolysis up to 4.5 hours from the original trials. And that was actually that the most benefit was seen to be between 0 and 3 hours after the onset of symptoms. But there was some benefit for people between 3 and 4.5 hours. And so now, obviously, the way that it was initially managed was that 4.5 hours was the gold standard for time for intervention. The theory for that being that beyond that 4.5 hour period, it's likely that people may well have developed significant infarct on scan or within the brain, and that trying to reperfuse that with clot busting drugs might actually start causing significant hemorrhage, and therefore the risks of giving people clot busting drugs would outweigh the benefits at that point. What we've started to see from the evidence, and there was trials like Extend, was trying to essentially try and select people out for thrombolysis and identifying people that may benefit from thrombolysis beyond that traditional window. And the way to try and get your head around it is essentially your brain is a bit like a sponge that's perfused by a large number of blood vessels through your circle of Willis. And obviously you've got left and right. And the beauty of the brain and the circle of Willis is that you get collateral flow. And if you are a young person with normally quite healthy vessels, you'll probably have what's called good collateral flow. So your plumbing that supplies both sides of the brain will help each other out if there is a problem. And so let's say, for example, you were having a large MCA, territory ischemic stroke. So that's the main kind of brain anterior circulatory artery that comes off your internal carotid. If that's blocked, you'll have a backup supply through your backup network. And so you might have a decent sort of support network of blood vessels to try and keep that bit of threatened brain alive for a longer period of time than, say, somebody who might be 85 with quite marked atherosclerotic vascular disease. So we've seen that there are some people that will actually benefit from clot busting drugs and other interventions like thrombectomy comfortably beyond that traditional 4.5 hour window. But the question is, well, how do you do that? And how do you select these people out? So a lot of this is very much dependent on where you work and what kind of imaging you've got available. And what I would say is we still obviously work to that 4.5 hour window as a bog standard using CT for clot busting drugs. The new guidance would suggest that between 4.5 and 9 hours, some people will benefit from clot busting drugs, so thrombolytic therapy. But that has to be done using very special brain imaging techniques. We usually use either CT perfusion or MR perfusion, because what we're looking at is how much brain is dead already and not savable, and how much brain is not yet dead but is under threat of dying if we don't do anything. And so if they've got a small dead bit, which is what we call a core, and a large salvageable bit called a penumbra, we might think about intervening for those people between 4.5 and 9 hours. So in a long-winded way, what I'm saying is we still use 4.5 hours as a standard for giving people thrombolysis for ischemic stroke. Between 4.5 and 9 hours, if you've got perfusion imaging, then we will do that to see if there are people that might benefit from it. That might not be everybody, but if we've got that capacity to do so, then we will do that for people too. So that's kind of time frames for thrombolysis.
That's interesting because, as you say, historically we're always taught the kind of the 4, 4.5 hours, and I mean, you might not have not even phoned the stroke consultant overnight if they came in at kind of 5 hours. Do you, where you're working, do they have CT perfusion out of hours?
No, so I work in in a district general emergency hospital in the northeast. We are in very close proximity to our tertiary neurosciences centre. So we are in the process of getting perfusion imaging. We're hoping to get it next year. So at the minute, we don't have the capacity to offer that service, and we're not transferring people for perfusion imaging between 4.5 and 9 hours. Just from a resource perspective, trying to get ambulances and transport everybody that presents just after 4.5 hours or 5 hours, it, logistically, is just too difficult. So, we're still struggling with those resource problems with hyperacute intervention, but we do hope to get it next year so that we can start doing that. And this is from a guideline that was published in April this year, the new 2023 National Stroke Guideline. So it's the last edition was 2016, and I think when we recorded the first of these podcast series, I don't think those guidelines had even actually come out yet. So things have changed even since then. And obviously, depending on where you work and what resources you've got, will give you the ability to do what the guidelines would recommend. And likewise, for example, if you have somebody that presents at 6 hours and you can clearly see there's marked ischemic change on the plain CT scan, then you wouldn't be proceeding to CT perfusion because you can already see on plain non-contrast CT that there's ischemic damage there already. So it's unlikely that they would have a significant salvageable a penumbra at that point.
Nice as a stroke consultant to potentially have like a new tool that you can be using to kind of hopefully help. And I imagine as a consultant, there's a very difficult position you're put in when they're around that 4.5 hour mark as to what to do with those patients.
Obviously I'm trying to sort of plug and sell stroke medicine, but we're changing the way that we make decisions, and I think things will change over the next 10 years or so. So we'll probably end up going away from a pure time based approach, which is kind of what we're doing already. And actually, we'll be using advanced brain imaging to make these decisions to actually see what a person's blood supply and perfusion is at the time. And if you like doing something a little bit different and you like a bit of acute, whether it be medicine or just sort of having something to kind of get your heart racing a little bit, but you also like other things like neuroimaging and being able to, be a specialist in other things, it is great. And the ability to kind of give people treatments that may benefit them when previously they might not have been eligible for it, is a real game changer. So, yeah, it is nice.
So, Chris, when you're kind of called down to see a patient who's potentially eligible for thrombolysis, kind of we've kind of talked about time, but what other factors are you looking at to see whether they'd meet the criteria to give them thrombolysis?
We could probably break this down into two things, and I think the first is, who you would and wouldn't thrombolize, and why would you or wouldn't you thrombolize them. So there is a popular misconception that I have heard floating around that you wouldn't thrombolize people according to what their NIH score is, and I think obviously we spoke about NIH before, which is our way of classifying how severe somebody's stroke is, and it gives you a score from 0 to 42. So 0 is you or I, we've got no symptoms at all. And then 42 is such a severe stroke that they're actually dead. Now, I've heard people say, well, you wouldn't thrombolize a stroke if the NIH is 3 or less, which just baffles me. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever because the question is, well, what deficit do they have to get that NIH of 3? Which could be quite a weak arm and not a very weak leg, but it's your dominant arm and you can't hold cup. So it's all about whether the stroke's disabling or not. So we would very much take everything on a case-by-case basis as to whether you would thrombolize somebody. And from the one end of minority, you've got, for example, Bob, who is a 40-year-old violinist who is right-handed, holds a bow in his right hand, but his left hand is his string control hand. So that obviously controls all the tone of the strings. And he presents with a very mild ischemic stroke affecting his left hand. NIH is 1 for a bit of loss of coordination and dexterity, but if you put a violin in his hand, he wouldn't be able to control the strings. So actually, it would ruin his career. And we've had somebody like that who we did thrombolize. So I would thrombolize that person with an NIH score of 1 because it's disabling. The other extreme you've got is I wouldn't thrombolize someone in a care home. Or I wouldn't thrombolize somebody that can't walk by themselves. And let's say, for example, you've got Ethel, who is 85 and has got crippling arthritis, is hoist transfer dependent for most cares physically, but actually cognitively is very sharp, loves listening to the radio and watching TV programs and having conversations with a family that come and visit her. well, if she presents with a stroke that consists of significant language impairment, she's actually lost one of her main facets of communication and enjoyment in life. So yes, obviously the risk is going to be higher for somebody like that, because if they're older and frailer, the bleeding risk is naturally going to be higher. But actually, I would thrombolize her because, you know, from a sensory perspective, she's lost a significant facet of what is enjoyable to her on a day-to-day basis. So I think, you know, thrombolysis, there's no hard and fast rules in terms of cutoffs for things. So nursing home, etc. Yes, of course, the risk is going to be high, but you have to take it on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
Obviously, what we do tend to worry about is if you've got somebody that's older and frailer and is coming later within that time window and the blood pressure is very high and the risks are all starting to mount up, then we have to make a careful risk-benefit decision about what we do. But in terms of the actual stroke, you just have to assess whether it's causing somebody a disability or not according to what their normal, you know, daily life and constitution actually is. Mm. So that's a bit of a bugbear, and it's a false rumor that you'll hear going around. So that's probably my main myth buster is, you know, there are no real rules about thrombolytic drugs. Thrombectomy is slightly different, and we'll probably maybe talk about thrombectomy in a sort of separate bit. And then thinking about other reasons as to why we wouldn't thrombolize people, and that's generally your sort of contraindications checklist that you'll see in an emergency department. Places usually have a stroke folder that sort of has a ticky box thing that kind of says, well, if you're answering yes to any of these questions, then you shouldn't be thrombolizing. And those checklists were generally developed from the exclusion criteria from the original research trials for stroke thrombolysis. So it's not necessarily that they are direct contraindications. It's just that people like that were thought to be at a higher risk of bleeding and therefore were excluded from the trials. So common ones that you'll see are things like recent heart attack in the previous 3 months, recent ischemic stroke within the past 3 months as contraindications to thrombolysis. And again, it very much depends on what kind of heart attack they had or what kind of stroke they had and when it was. Yeah. Because let's say 2 months ago, somebody had a tiny thalamic infarct, but presented with a new big stroke. Well, I certainly would thrombolize them because it was a small stroke. It was a small infarct. It was some time ago, and therefore the risk of bleeding is probably going to be quite low at that point. But let's say, for example, someone had had a STEMI 2 days before they had a very big ischemic stroke. Well, the risk of, you know, ventricular free wall rupture and major cardiac hemorrhage is probably going to be very high for that person. So thrombolysis probably wouldn't be a good idea. But let's say, for example, they had a minor medically managed NSTEMI 8 weeks ago. You know, again, probably would thrombolize that person in conjunction with a quick chat with a cardiologist. So those sorts of contraindications are, I would call them relative contraindications or points for thought, really. It's likewise whether somebody's had a major operation. It very much depends what it is. And I've thrombolized someone who had a shoulder replacement 3 days yeah. beforehand. You know, we spoke to the orthopedic surgeon. They were happy with the kind of hemostasis. They said, do it. We'll support whatever problems we need. That's fine. But you know, you have to take those sorts of things very much on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
Things that definitely make me think of an absolute no-no. Have they very recently had an intracranial hemorrhage? You know, let's say within the past year or so. That would definitely be a worrying sign. A previous history of intracranial hemorrhage at any point is not an absolute contraindication to thrombolysis, which some people often think, but it isn't. But then you have to think about why it was that they'd had that bleed in the first place. And if they've got something like an underlying angiopathy or yeah. they've got an AV malformation that's not been intervened with, that's clearly not a good idea. But again, it's just, you know, I think what we're seeing now is we would rather you just discuss things with us to make sure that we're not missing out on people that could be eligible for certain treatments. The some things on top of kind of very recent intracranial hemorrhage, if somebody's had an LP within the previous week,
yeah,
it's not a great idea, so I wouldn't be doing on that. If their platelet count is below 100 and it's known to be below 100, that's an absolute contraindication. But I wouldn't be waiting for a full blood count to come back before I start giving people clot-busting drugs. It's just, let's say, for example, they're known to have ITP, and they had a platelet count done 3 days ago by hematology, and it was four. Then they're probably, you know, that's going to do some serious damage. The other thing probably is about anticoagulants, which
that's what I was going to ask, because I think it's got more and more complicated with the new anticoagulants, hasn't it?
So that's a bit tricky. Warfarin, which we're seeing fewer and fewer people on it, but obviously people still are on it. If their INR is less than 1.7, you can thrombolize them safely. If the INR is over 1.7, then the bleeding risk is too high. That's the threshold. If you have a point of care INR very quickly, you've got an idea about what you can and can't do. The DOACs, if they've had a DOAC within 24 hours of, prior to presentation, the risk of bleeding is too high. If they've got normal renal function and it's between 24 and 48 hours that they had their last dose, we would tend to do an assay to see exactly what level of apixaban, rivaroxaban, dabigatran, et cetera, they've got in their system. And the lab will be able to give you standardized cutoffs as to what level it would be deemed that they don't have a therapeutic level of anticoagulant in the bloodstream.
Have there been any trials like looking at the reversal agent with these newer anticoagulants?
So that's quite an interesting point. I think it's particularly for using Praxbind and dabigatran. And some centres in Europe will reverse to thrombolyse because they feel that actually trying to get rid of the anticoagulant to make thrombolysis safe will give you a kind of better, you know, therapeutic effect of trying to remove what clot is there rather than preventing new clot forming, which is obviously the idea of the anticoagulants. Our current guidelines are that that's not what we would do. So it's not recommended to be giving people reversal agents in order to thrombolize. It's done in some places in Europe, but it's not what we do, and I've never done it personally. Conceptually, it just sort of doesn't really make sense in my mind. But some places do it.
Get the assays back in good time.
It varies. My experience is it generally takes about half an hour to 40 minutes. So you need some time. You know, people have to arrive in good time for you to give that. But you can do it. And I have thrombolized and not thrombolized based on those results. If people have got renal impairment, you know, realistically, it's kind of, you've got to be over 48 hours without no activity thinking about thrombolizing. I mean, what we'll sometimes see is people that come in who've had it suspended for a surgical procedure, maybe 3 or 4 days down the line. And you know, it's that makes the decision a bit easier. But yeah, if you're not sure, then we can always do an assay. Yeah, so anticoagulants are an interesting one. I suppose the other thing is blood pressure, which is one of the other reasons as to why you may or may not be giving people clot busting drugs. And obviously, with the facets of time for intervention, if your blood pressure is over 185 over 110, that's the cutoff at which you can't actively give people clot busting drugs. But what we obviously do is give people medication to bring their blood pressure down so that we can thrombolize them. But let's say, for example, you've got somebody with an ischemic stroke who's quite frail and it's 4 hours 25 and the blood pressure is 230 over 110. You know, I think at that point you have to say, well, realistically, how long is it going to take us to start getting the blood pressure down? And therefore the risk of bleeding is just going to go up as time goes by with frailty and comorbidity. So that's the other thing that just sometimes tips the balance in the decision making.
Yeah. And just on that, in terms of managing blood pressure in acute ischemic stroke, if you're not going to thrombolize, would you reduce that blood pressure anyway in that patient?
Generally not, unless it's exceptionally high or they've got features of hypertensive encephalopathy or significant end organ signs. So generally for acute ischemic stroke that you're not going to perform any hyperacute interventions with, I'll leave the blood pressure alone.
Yeah.
Because realistically, it's the brain's physiological way of trying to save itself by trying to increase perfusion. It's not quite clear the way that it works, but you're therefore going to be intervening with an autoregulatory process of the brain trying to fix itself. You know, I think if somebody's blood pressure, for example, is 260, I might give them something to bring their blood pressure down at that point, but that's rare.
Yeah.
And actually the current guidance for us nationally is that we shouldn't be attempting to intervene with blood pressure in ischemic stroke that's not undergoing intervention. So generally not.
And for the patients that you might want to thrombolize, what kind of agents are you using to bring your blood pressure down?
It partly depends where you work because
Yeah.
different places use different drugs. But for me personally, and where I work, as long as people haven't got severe asthma or they're not bradycardic, I'd go for giving them boluses of labetalol first line.
Yeah.
So I'd usually give them 10, 10, 20 at sort of 5 minute, 5 to 10 minute intervals to try and bring the blood pressure down. If that doesn't work, I'd put them on a GTN infusion to try and help bring the blood pressure down. And often what happens is even if you get someone's blood pressure down to the safe threshold of 185, 110 with some labetalol, it's very likely that they'll need to go on a maintenance infusion of something like GTN. Obviously, if someone's got something like horrendous aortic stenosis, it's not a good idea to be giving them nitrates. So we would probably give them something like a labetalol infusion at that point. But again, they're a rarity.
Yeah.
Chris, one of the questions I always have is, as a doctor calling a consultant in the middle of the night about potential thrombolysis, what are the key things that I should be leading with when I've woken you up from your sleep?
It's a good question. I think one of the things I would say, which is it's not even really a stroke related thing, but maybe a tip if you're phoning anybody in the middle of the night, is you'd be amazed at how awake and how much adrenaline you have when you're in that clinical situation in the middle of the night that you might not even realize. And quite often I'll get phoned and they've already told me the history and the examination findings that there's a CT scan to look at before I've even really woken up. And so I'll say, well, you're just gonna have to tell me all that again because I've just woken up. And sometimes actually it's good to lead with a kind of, sorry, I've woken you up. Do you want a minute just to kind of load up your laptop and we'll have a chat about it? Just because it then gives me a minute to sort of get my head in the game and think, right, crikey, we need to have a think about what's going on here and have a look at the scan and load. We usually have a laptop from home that we can look at the images. I think that's probably the first thing. The second thing I think realistically is what's the actual story and what are the examination findings? And then you can lead into the they've got a background history of X, Y, and Z, and they take various medications. Because what you want to know is what is the stroke syndrome that we're dealing with here? Is this just a face, arm, and leg weakness, or is this a major disabling total anterior circulation stroke? So I've got an idea in my mind about what I can see in my head that's in front of you. And different places have different facilities. So some places use kind of like a SMOTS camera so that the consultant at home can actually see the patient and you can kind of tell them what to do from home. So, smile and lift your arm and lift your leg and let's have a look at their visual fields and so on. We tend to just go via telephone because where I work, we have a stroke nurse practitioner that's on 24/7. So I think what I would say is give us a minute to wake up. What's the clinical story, which needs to be snappy and essentially just needs to be, at what time did they have X neurological symptoms and the time is now, whatever, sort of 11 p.m. was brushing the teeth, and then all of a sudden right arm and right leg was weak and they fell to the floor. And just for reference, it's now 1:30 in the morning because sometimes I might not have even woken up and twigged what the actual time is, so that you have an idea about where we are in the sort of grander scheme of events. The clinical examination really doesn't have to need technical terms. It's just to say what you see. And actually, that's sometimes when an NIH chart in front of you can come in really handy. So our A&E department has, as I said before, a stroke file, which in the front of it has lots of blank NIH score sheets so that you can go through it to kind of give a score. And actually, if you just ring me and say, I've got this lady who at, midnight started with sudden onset, right face, arm, and leg weakness, and I'll go through the NIH with you. That's the best way because that's how my brain thinks when I'm thinking about examining somebody for stroke. Their gaze is deviated to the left. They don't really seem to be attentive to the right-hand side, and the arm and leg drift to bed in 3 seconds when I hold them up. That's more than enough information for me. I know exactly what it is that I'm dealing with at that point. So if you can do it in that structured way, it's presenting the information to me in the way that I normally do it in the day, rather than, the tone's normal, I've done reflexes and things that you don't really need to do in acute stroke. So I think keep the examination succinct and just say the obvious things. It doesn't really need to be technical. Or at least to me anyway, I don't necessarily want it to be technical. I just want to know what the deficit is. And then the other thing is, the one thing sometimes that I get phoned with is, well, the arm and the leg drifts and the power's probably about 4/4-. And you think, well, okay. And the big way that you can tell for people like that is walk them. So if they can get up off an A&E trolley and they can walk and you don't need to hold on to them, then their motor function is good enough for me to think that's probably not disabling if it's just kind of arm and leg weakness, for example. But let's say you examine someone on a trolley and the arm drifts a bit and the leg drifts a bit, and let's say the power's 4 out of 5. You don't really know whether that's disabling or not to warrant giving someone clot busting drugs that have got a risk. So to me, walking someone will tell you an awful lot, because if they can transfer and they can walk, that's okay.
That's
Obviously, if they've
such a
got
good
other
tip.
features, I mean, it doesn't account for kind of cortical things like dysphagia or hemianopia, which could also
Yeah.
be disabling. But let's say, Bob, who's 68 and smokes 40 a day and drinks too much alcohol, comes in with, a bit of facial droop and a bit of arm and a bit of leg weakness. The only way you're going to really know whether it's disabling enough to thrombolyze is by walking them. So
Yeah.
that's the big tip really from me.
Also, I suppose sometimes you're worried, aren't you, about getting people with potential stroke up because of weakness, and but as you say, it's a good indicator of the severity, which is inform your decisions about thrombolysis. So that's a really good tip.
And the way that you can do it in a really quick manner is when you go with them to the scanner and you take them to the scanner bed, and they're obviously on a trolley. What are they like when you try and transfer them onto the scanner bed? Are they all over the place and need two or three of you and the radiographer to hold them? Or actually, can they just get on by themselves? Because again, that it immediately gives you a bit of an idea of, I'd still want to be wrong about somebody like that because they've got acute neurological signs consistent with stroke within a window where we could give them treatment. And that's not to say that it might deteriorate in half an hour so that they can't do that.
Yeah.
At which point you might proceed differently, but on that initial assessment, that's the one big thing that we tend to do that, it's just kind of a bit of common sense, but you don't tend to really think about it an awful lot.
Yeah.
So that's probably the big one. And then essentially, once you've kind of phoned and said this is the story and we've done an examination, the things that I'm going to want to know are, well, what's the blood sugar and what's the blood pressure? Because A, are they just hypo, which you'd hope we'd have ruled out by that point, but I have seen it. And well, am I going to now need to start giving blood pressure lowering therapy or be telling you to be giving blood pressure lowering therapy? So that also gives you a bit of an idea about what we need to do. And then as part of obviously that initial discussion, I would usually prompt to say, well, have they been in hospital recently? What's the medical background? Are they on any regular medications? And with the advent of online health records now, I can see that from home too. So
Yeah.
it's I'm not solely reliant on the information that I'm being given over the phone, because I can also see it for myself. But those other things are also quite useful. So
And
yeah, I think they're probably the big things I would say.
that's good. And then can I ask you about your way of speaking to a patient or their relatives about thrombolysis, consenting for it, or kind of explaining it and explaining the risks and benefits?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the way that I would phrase it, and that's based on evidence from a lot of the original stroke trials, but also something called the SITS Most database, which is the Safety and Thrombolysis Stroke database, which has kind of accrued all of the adverse outcomes from stroke thrombolysis. Is what I would generally say my patter is, clinically this looks like you're having a stroke, and sometimes the way that you kind of get that across can be a little bit tricky as well, because you don't want to start putting people's blood pressure up by stressing them out by these sorts of things, which, because then you're gonna have to start getting drugs out and whatnot. So what I tend to say is I tend to use the word small quite often, maybe inappropriately, even if it's not that small, but just so that we're not kind of over egging the pudding, so to
Yeah.
speak. So we tend to say something like, I think you're having a small stroke because of a lack of blood flow to the brain. And that's usually caused by a blood clot. And because you are within a certain time frame, we've got the ability to try and see if we can remove that clot or at least break that clot up to see if we can improve your symptoms. And then what I'd say is, if we were to give this treatment to 100 people, we would expect 30 people to get significantly better from this treatment. So generally the chance of improvement is probably about 30%. And there are variations of that. We kind of think probably 10% will get significantly better, almost to the point of trying to achieve independence according to stroke size. And other people might not do quite so well, but will be better than they were when they were thrombolized. And then the bleeding risk generally is, and that's according to what kind of type of bleeding it was categorized on for the trials. But I would say there's a 7% risk of significant bleeding, which could be from anywhere. And let's say, for example, people have had ulcers and they've had an OGD 4 months ago, for example, the risk of bleeding from a stomach might be higher than somebody who've not had that. The big one is a 3% risk of major hemorrhage, which could be fatal. So that's the big number, really. And people tend to sort of balk at that when you say, there is a 3% risk of major bleeding, which could potentially be fatal because it would be bleeding within the brain. But then what I would always say is we would not offer you this treatment if we did not think the benefit outweighed the risk. And that's always the end point. And generally when put like that, I'm not obviously not making people have this treatment. It's entirely up to them and it's a shared decision. But generally most people will accept it because of what stroke is and the emotive nature of stroke. So yeah, generally, I mean, the take is 30% of people will get better. 7% might have significant bleeding, but 3% might have fatal hemorrhage, which is usually intracranial.